Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of December. This hour of the program, Elliot Cohen is with us, author of Conquered into Liberty, Two Centuries of Battles Along the Great War Path That Made the American Way of War. He writes in the beginning of the book, I'd like to read this because it describes the breadth of his experience and knowledge. His parents' generation fought and won the Great War against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. So World War II was a living memory as he grew up. When he was a graduate student, he studied America's Cold War. And in the new century, as a senior government official, he was an advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He advised the secretary and interagency colleagues about our wars with Iraqi insurgents, the Taliban, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, and Al-Qaeda, and spent a good deal of time visiting battlefields in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and as well as shaping strategy in Washington. So it's actually fortuitous that we have him on the day that the U.S. war in Iraq has been officially declared over, although that's not the focus of this conversation. I will ask him about it during the course of the hour. At any rate, he left government service in 2009 and eagerly resumed work, he says, on his book, which deals with America's most durable and in many ways most effective and important enemy of all, Canada. Yes, Canada. Professor Elliot Cohen is our guest. He has quite a background. He's a professor of strategic studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He has taught many, many places. He served, as I said, as counselor of the U.S. Department of State. He's a former professor at Harvard and the U.S. Naval War College. He directed the U.S. Air Force's Gulf War Air Power Survey, was a member of the Defense Policy Board, and has written a number of books. This is one of them, and another which was so highly acclaimed, Supreme Command, Soldiers, Statesmen, and Wartime Leadership. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Elliot Cohen. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Professor Elliot Cohen, thank you so much for being with us.
Very good to be with you.
So Canada, I think that probably surprises a lot of people. We don't know enough about Canada, do we? You say that in the book.
We actually know very little about Canada. And I know there's something that sounds a little bit comic about that introduction, but it is true. I mean, this was the big strategic fact in the life of the United States. And before that, the colonies, going back to the 17th century. Of course, now, you know, we have this... they're our friendly neighbor to the north, and it's an undefended frontier. But that's not the way it was. And I hope that the book, I hope, will do a couple things. Partly reacquaint people with some very interesting history, but also I hope it'll get people to think a little bit differently about Canada.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it does indeed. For almost two centuries, you're right, Canada was the greatest threat to England's American colonies and the young United States. Why?
Well, it was a threat, not in the sense of an existential threat, but it was really the source, the main source of really serious conflict along the frontier. The book opens with the destruction of the town of Schenectady, which is not far from Albany, New York, in 1690. And one way of thinking about that, that's the first really major incident of state-sponsored terrorism in this hemisphere. Mm. It was a very deliberate French effort to pin down and disperse English forces along the frontier. And, you know, you then have what the English colonies and then the United States, in one way or another, taking part in a whole series of what are really world wars from the end of the 17th century through the War of 1812, which in its way is a spinoff of the Napoleonic Wars. And what made the Canada as a problem so difficult was that it was under a European powers control, first under France, then under Great Britain, but closely allied with Native Americans, and able, I think, to make them much more effective along the frontier than they otherwise would have been. We tend to forget how seriously people took that as a threat in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a chance that Native Americans could cast off the French and the British?
No, I don't think so. The book really opens at the end of the 17th century. Earlier on in the 17th century, the Indians are really very powerful, independent actors, particularly the Iroquois Confederation. But by the time you get to, let's say, the beginning of the 18th century, the Indians are they're very important, and they are somewhat autonomous, and the British and French are competing for their loyalties. But the Indians have just been devastated demographically by disease and warfare, probably disease more than warfare. So they're at a big disadvantage. They're at a technological disadvantage. And really what you see, I think, throughout the 18th century is the Indians trying to negotiate their way through this, understanding all the time that there's this huge demographic pressure coming out of the English colonies that will eventually sweep across the continent. But for the Indians, their last real hope was the War of 1812, because the British actually had as their war aim creating an Indian buffer state to the west of the United States that would be essentially under British protection. And they give that up at the end of the War of 1812 as an objective. And after that, it's really pretty hopeless for American Indians as really independent political entities.
You mentioned Schenectady, the raid, and you talk about the American reaction to this, to seek the conquest of Canada with the aim of eliminating France's political presence in North America. Who stated that as a goal? How do we even think that we might be able to accomplish that, to conquer Canada?
Well, of course, the first point to make about the Schenectady raid, or the Schenectady massacre, as the locals called it, was that actually most of the raiding party consisted of French Canadians, not of Indians. So, you know, there was an awareness that this was really coming out of Canada. And I would say this, the determination that it would, that ultimately French rule in Canada would have to go, was something that I think most prominent people in, particularly in New York and New England, already felt quite strongly by the early 18th century. And so that would be both British officials who were sent over here, but also the local elites who had experienced this on the frontier. You know, initially the leaders of Schenectady thought that they weren't likely to be hit by the French because they've been trading with them and with the Indians, and they of course found out otherwise. Now, it took a long time before the English were able to conquer Canada, and it eventually was done largely with regular British troops, not with American provincial troops.
Tell me about this, because I always like to find out why people do what they do. Why is it that you, with your expertise in so many parts of the world right now, and your counseling Secretary of State Rice, and being a person who has gone to the Middle East, to many of these battlefields many times, why did you go back when you left the State Department to the Great War Path?
Well, honestly, I have to tell you, it was a place that fascinated me as a boy. And I read a novelist named Kenneth Roberts, who was very prominent in the 1930s. He was a wonderful historical novelist who wrote about that period, and it got me very interested in it. I then went off and did other things. And then in the 1990s, I began going back to this region. We were running some executive education programs for the Pentagon, and I do something called staff rides, where you take people to a battlefield and you give them different roles to play, and you try to understand what happened and then to extract larger lessons from it. So I was taking groups of colonels and generals up to this region, and the same fascination hit me, only now it wasn't just a boy's fascination. It was the fascination of somebody who'd been used to thinking about large strategic kinds of issues and dealing with the government about it. And the more I read into it, the more interesting I found it, and the more I came to the conclusion that in order to understand the way in which Americans approach war, even today, you really need to go pretty far back into the past. So that was the real motivation of it. I should add beyond that, I believe very strongly that if you want to really contribute to contemporary discourse, it's very good to be anchored in the past.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no doubt about that, as we all should be, right? And many of us aren't. You wrote in a Wall Street Journal piece, "The American way of war is distinctive. If the armed services have an unofficial motto, it is whatever it takes." Is that motto the same as conquering into liberty?
No, I would say it's different, but it comes from the same place. The title of the book, Conquered into Liberty, comes from a pamphlet that was distributed through Canada by American secret agents in 1775. People don't always realize, we invaded Canada before we had even declared independence. And in advance of that, this pamphlet, which was in French, was distributed around, and it was addressed to the habitants, the French inhabitants of Canada, then under British rule, saying, and it begins, "You have been conquered into liberty." And one of the themes I pick up in the book is that's a very peculiar idea.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But it is something we've been doing for a long time. And it's what we did with Germany and Japan in World War II. And I think you could argue in a certain way it's what we did or tried to do in Iraq. So it's a very deep-seated way that we've had about thinking about war, which makes us pretty distinctive. The whatever it takes side, I think, emerged from the kind of warfare that occurs in the 18th century in this part of the world. And the book is mainly about what the Indians call the Great War Path, the 200 miles of woodland and water between Albany and Montreal. And what evolved was a form of warfare which was in some ways like European warfare in terms of the organizations and so on, but in another way it was very different. I mean, it went around the year, for example, which is not the way European warfare worked. There were many fewer conventions. There was a lot more improvisation that you had to engage in. And so I think that became part of our military culture. And it's, again, lasted to the present day.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say just a few words, because we are speaking to you on the day when the U.S. war in Iraq has declared officially over, and I know that you were intimately involved in visiting these countries and helping design U.S. policy. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what you think about today.
Well, I've got, I guess, all kinds of feelings about it. I had lots of friends and family who've served in Iraq, and I've been there a lot. I was in favor of the war. I was initially critical of how the Bush administration conducted it. Then I found myself asked to join the administration and help sort it out. You know, I guess my basic feeling is whether one was in favor of the war or opposed to it, there really was a major accomplishment, not just in the removal of Saddam Hussein, but the establishment of an Iraqi state which will be more or less aligned, I think, with the United States, and which has the potential, at least, to be a kind of model for a very disturbed part of the world. I was very disappointed that we weren't able to conclude a deal with the Iraqis to keep some sort of small residual force there. I think they're going to need that, actually. And we'll see. My feeling when I left government, which was really the last time that I visited the country and was following it intimately, was it was on a fragile trajectory to success.
Mm-hmm.
And that itself, given what we were dealing with, was a pretty huge accomplishment.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, who's written a very, very interesting book about a time in history that we don't know very much about, actually. Elliot Cohn is our guest. He's also the author of the highly acclaimed Supreme Command. This book is Conquered into Liberty, two centuries of battles along the great war path that made the American way of war. He is now a professor of strategic studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and he was counselor to the U.S. Department of State, serving as Secretary Condoleezza Rice's senior advisor on strategic issues. He has taught many other places, and He's our guest this hour. His areas of expertise include Afghanistan, Pakistan, Western Europe, Middle East, Iran, Iraq, and, of course, the Great War Path that he writes about in this book, Issues, Diplomacy, International Relations, Irregular Warfare, Military History, Military Power and Strategy, Strategic and Security Issues. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation if you would like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. My family and I were watching, as we do every night, Jeopardy, and so I brought up in front of the guys, can anybody tell me about Fort Ticonderoga? We hear that word, but how many of us can pinpoint exactly what happened there? And our guest, of course, writes about that in his book and visits a museum there, too, which is significant. So we will talk about that. And I must say that my husband did know about Fort Ticonderoga. So we'll talk. It's all these filled with names of people and different takes on some of the prominent names in American history, like Benedict Arnold. So we'll welcome your phone calls and talk more in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Elliot Cohn is our guest. His latest book is Conquered into Liberty, Two Centuries of Battles Along the Great War Path That Made the American Way of War. Let's answer the question, what happened at Fort Ticonderoga, by you're telling us the story of the knapsack of Benjamin Warner. It's sometimes a more interesting way to remember history, to hear about these kinds of things. Why do you make mention of the knapsack of Benjamin Warner?
Well, let me just first say Fort Ticonderoga is a it's a fort that's right on the at the junction of Lake George and Lake Champlain, so it's quite a strategic area. And the French built a fort there, then the British built a fort. In the book, I mention this artifact. It's a haversack, a linen bag, basically, that was left to the museum at Fort Ticonderoga, which is a beautifully reconstructed site, by a guy named Benjamin Warner. And he his story is a very typical kind of story. This is a guy who served repeatedly in the American Revolution. He was in the militia. He goes, he fights, he goes back home, comes back, fights again. And then he retired in the Ticonderoga area. And in 1837, a very old man, he writes a note to his son, to whom he leaves the knapsack. And if I might, I'll just read what the inscription is.
Yes.
You can see this in the museum. It says, "This knapsack I carried through the War of the Revolution, excuse me, to achieve the American independence, and I transmit it to my oldest son to keep it and transmit it to his oldest son, and so on to the latest posterity. And whilst one shred of it shall remain, never surrender your liberties to a foreign invader or an aspiring demagogue." So it's 1837. One of the things I try to do in the book is tell the story of some people. Some of the stories are of famous people like Benedict Arnold or George Washington, but some of the stories are of people that you may not have heard of, including Benjamin Warner, including some loyalists, including French Canadians. And as we were discussing earlier, we often don't know a whole lot about French Canadian history, which is really very, very interesting indeed.
Mm-hmm. You also write that you like to write about leaders in the middle.
Yes. Well, I think when people write military history, they tend to write either about the generals or they tend to write about the life of the private soldier. And I do some of that in this book, but I also think it's very important to write about the people in the middle who actually make things happen. So a couple of examples. One is a self-taught engineer named Jeduthan Baldwin, who becomes really the founder of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who builds a lot of the fortifications at Mount Independence, which is across the water from Fort Ticonderoga. he suffers from smallpox. You know, he kept a very interesting journal, which I quote, and is eventually there for the great victory over the British at Saratoga. And again, a bit like Benjamin Warner, somebody who just showed up and did his duty. Mm-hmm. And it's to people like that we owe our independence in the long run.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls. Casey in Port Wing is our first caller. Hi, Casey.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Awesome. I would like to make a special note to your author there of the place our Native Americans have played in our military since even the Revolutionary War. Many Native Americans have fought for the Americans, even though it was their country first, and we kind of took it over from them. Right up to today, including Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, the Native Americans have paid a very high price in our military, and most of them, all of them, with gallantry and honor. And I would like to also include a Native American from the Ho-Chunk tribe from Black River Falls, who received the Medal of Honor posthumously from Black River Falls, Wisconsin. His last name was Red Cloud. And the Native Americans have paid a heavy price in the freedoms for our country. And I would hope all Americans acknowledge that, the price that the Native Americans have paid in our military. Thank you.
Thanks, Casey.
You know, if I could respond to that, I think that's that is absolutely right. And, of course, you can't read this history and write this history without getting a sense of, in many ways, what a raw deal Native Americans did get. But it is a curious thing about our history, the way in which we commemorate that. So that, the very first helicopter I rode in when I was in ROTC as a graduate student is a Huey, but its real name is an Iroquois. Mm. You know, the most lethal helicopter in just about anybody's inventory is the United States Army's Apache. So the Native American legacy and lineage is really quite important, and it is interesting how we have sustained it. But I quite agree with the caller. It is, I'll just say, as an historian, it is challenging to write about Native Americans because the written records on the Indian side are so few.
Mm-hmm.
So frequently you've got the challenge of viewing the Indians as Europeans saw them, which of course is kind of problematic.
Right. Thanks, Casey, for the call. Dirk in Milwaukee. Hi, Dirk.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was curious if you could make any mention of something a little closer to Wisconsin here. Mackinac Island and Sault Ste. Marie and their involvement.
I wish I could, but I really can't. The only connection comes through one of the figures in the book, and that's Robert Rogers, who was the founder of Rogers Rangers, which is the unit that today is the 75th Ranger Regiment of the United States Army. After service in along the Great Warpath route in upstate New York, he is subsequently sent west, and he plays an important role there. But I'm afraid I really focused my attention very much on the Great Warpath route, so I can't really speak to that as much. One thing I will say, though, is you mentioned Sault Ste. Marie. Again, this speaks to the French-Canadian influence. We have all these French place names, and we often don't ask ourselves, well, how did that come about? And the reason they come about is because French Canadians were spread all over the West in the 18th century, and they were remarkably enterprising. After the conquest of Canada in 1759, in many ways they kind of shrink into themselves, and so we've forgotten a large part of that story.
Thank you very much, Dirk, for the call. And I don't know if we have ever explained exactly, which we probably should, what the Great Warpath was, what this 200-mile route was.
Right. And the Great Warpath is what the Indians called this route, basically between Albany, what's today Albany, and Montreal. And it's largely a water route shaped by Lake George and Lake Champlain. At the very north, you have the Richelieu River. At the south, of course, you have the Hudson River. And this was the great, it was not an artery of commerce, but it was a route along which first Indian raiding parties and then English and French and American armies and raiding bodies moved back and forth. And really, through the Civil War, it was understood to be the main corridor for a potential invasion of Canada. And in fact, even a little bit beyond the Civil War, the United States Army Corps of Engineers is finishing a massive fort called Fort Montgomery, just about a mile south of the border. And it's clearly a potential jumping-off point for an invasion of Canada, as absurd as that sounds. So this is basically a military highway, but a highway made largely of water.
Mm-hmm. Dirk, thank you for your call. James is next in Evansville. Hi, James.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest comment about the unofficial motto of the armed forces being, quote-unquote, whatever it takes, I was just wondering, is that mantra or motto kind of coming to an end? Because I see in places like Afghanistan where, I don't know if just flying drones around, you know, crashing them into buildings and trying to kill people is going to do it. I mean, through history, we see only one man or one, you know, empire has ever conquered that country. You know, but correct me if I'm wrong, but it was Alexander the Great. And I just don't see us in this contemporary warfare we're waging over there. I don't think it's going to get it done. I saw this wonderful dissertation on C-SPAN that the expert basically said, unless we're prepared to go from cave to cave, that criminal element, the Taliban, we're not going to be able to root that element out. So I'm just wondering if your guest had any comments on the way we wage war. Is it whatever it takes?
Well, let me distinguish between two different things. One is how we think Afghanistan will turn out and whether it's possible to succeed there. That's one conversation, which I'd be happy to have with you. But the other is really sort of the frame of mind and the military culture of our armed forces, which I've seen quite a bit of in the field. And I would say that culture of whatever it takes is still very much there. That is to say, a willingness to improvise, to change what you're doing, frequently to make lots of mistakes. You know, there's a very interesting memoir that the German Marshal Erwin Rommel made, wrote shortly after the Normandy landings. He was in an accident, was recovering, and really never went back on active duty. But he was writing a memoir, and he said he had the experience of fighting both Americans and Brits. And he said the thing about the Americans is they make lots of mistakes. They come in with ideas which may not make a whole lot of sense, but what really struck him was the extent to which they would adapt. And I think that is still very much characteristic of the United States Armed Forces. There's also a grimmer side to this, which is there's a kind of ruthlessness, I think, about the American way of war. And in World War II, you saw it in things like the bombing of Tokyo or Dresden or what have you, which is not—it's not sadistic, but it is, you know, a kind of ruthless determination, and it means that you see it in the Civil War, you see it in World War II, and I think it's just part of our culture. We're, you know, once there's a mission, people tend to be very focused on it. And once again, having seen senior officers from other countries in similar situations, they will often be much more inclined to say, well, I just kind of give up on this one, or we, you know, let's minimize our losses. And Americans, once you give them the mission, they'll say whatever it takes. Hmm. That doesn't guarantee success or failure in any particular situation, though.
Isn't that also true of German warfare, Japanese warfare, Russian warfare?
Yes and no. I mean, I would say not entirely. You know, each of those countries has distinctive ways of approaching warfare. I think we're probably a little bit more willing to change forms and to do completely different kinds of things, and to throw out theory. You know, the Russians in Afghanistan never quite adapted to waging counterinsurgency, I would argue, in the way that that we have. Same thing with with the Germans. They could be, I mean, all these people can be very hard and very ruthless. But I'm not sure quite as adaptable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, James, for your call. Randy in Key Wascom. Hi.
Yes. Your guest, thank you for taking my call. Your guest was talking about the Iroquois helicopter, and one of the most brilliant tacticians during the Revolutionary War that fought with the British was Joseph Brant. And a lot of our ruthlessness came from the way we had to fight the Native Americans. You know, and the Iroquois were a real good example. You know, they were very organized, and they waged complete warfare. I mean, you know, the massacre at German Flats, unfortunately, it didn't turn out well for them because the revolutionaries countered in suit.
You know, I agree. Joseph Brant was one of the a very impressive Indian leader. I would say in the War of 1812, Tecumseh, who was killed fairly early on in a battle in Canada, was another. And I think your listener makes another very, very good point about the ruthlessness of the Iroquois. And I think that's the other part of trying to have a rounded picture of Native Americans. The Iroquois were ruthless, and they made quite systematic use of terror. There's a rather grisly story, which I tell, which illustrates this point, of a raid that the Iroquois were conducting against the Miami Indians in the Midwest. And they're being pursued back. And as they're being pursued back, what they do is at every one of their they'd taken a whole bunch of kids who they intended to adopt into the tribe. And at every one of their camping places, they would leave a head on a stick for the pursuers to find as a way of terrifying them. And it's, you know, it's grim. But this was a feature of Indian warfare as well. And that, you know, that permeated our consciousness. But it's important to bear in mind as you try to have some sort of perspective on the frontier experience and on the warfare between colonists and the Indians.
Let's spend just a few moments talking about, because I like to learn history through people sometimes, and you have a different interpretation of Benedict Arnold, a brilliant strategist. Our memory of him is that he was a horrible traitor. Fill out our perceptions of him.
Well, Arnold is a fascinating character, and he's the period that I cover in the book is really his heroic period. And I think you really can make the case that we would not have won independence without Arnold. He leads the initial invasion of Canada. He conducts a very as effective a rearguard action as we retreat from Canada as possible. He builds a fleet out of nothing. He delays the British invasion by a year, and then when the British invade the next year in 1777, he really deserves most of the credit for the American success. During the course of this period, his wife dies. He basically spends his fortune in the Patriot cause. He is wounded twice in the same leg and crippled for life. And throughout, he's persecuted by political enemies and in many ways by Congress. So I come away thinking of him as a tragic figure more than anything else. And then in the book, what I try to do in each of the chapters, which are built around a series of battles, is I try to bring it forward a bit and talk about how we process these memories. And with Arnold, of course, the memory is the treason. One of the haunting things about Arnold is the way we memorialize him. So when a monument is put up on the Saratoga battlefield, it's this five-story high monument, and there are these niches for the life-size statues of the leaders. There are four niches. Three of them are filled with the two Northern Front commanders, and then Daniel Morgan, who was the commander of the riflemen, who plays a very important role. And the fourth niche, which faces the battlefield, is left empty. At West Point, at the old chapel, where they have the names of all the generals of the Revolution, they chiseled into stone. They chiseled his name in, and then they chiseled it out again.
Hmm.
And it's but when you get into it, you realize it's actually it's more of a tragic story. And yet, and I raised this in the book. I said, let's think about this. Who did more damage to the United States, Benedict Arnold or Robert E. Lee? And that's an uncomfortable question to pose, but somehow we've made Robert E. Lee an American hero.
Yes, we have.
Although I would argue he did infinitely more damage to this country than Benedict Arnold ever did, and Lord knows we owe a lot more to Arnold than we do to Lee.
But Lee was such a gentleman.
Yeah, fighting for the cause of chattel slavery.
Right, right. More phone calls in just one moment. We're speaking this hour with Elliot Cohen, who's author of Conquered Into Liberty, Two Centuries of Battles Along the Great War Path That Made the American Way of War. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This is a 200-mile stretch of water and woodland path that the Native Americans called the Great War Path. For two centuries, for Indians, Europeans, Americans, and Canadians, it was where they contested for control of the North American continent, a little written about and known about period in history. And Elliot found it extremely fascinating and has written a highly acclaimed book. It's been receiving terrific reviews. And he has a very interesting background as well. He is also author, some of you may be familiar with, Supreme Command, Soldiers, Statesmen, and Wartime Leadership, which was an award-winning book he wrote back in 2002. He served as counselor of the U.S. Department of State and has was counselor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, so he has been involved in helping devise strategy for Iraq and Afghanistan and has been to that part of the world frequently. He's a former professor at Harvard and at the U.S. Naval War College, and he is our guest this hour. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Jim in Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Yes, to get to my point is I hope your book emphasizes that this is it deals with the first step that deviates away from the vision of the founding fathers of this country, that being of a republic, and quickly flipping fast forward to the international empire of today, where we have 850 military installations in 130 different countries and are doing a good half of the entire world's military expenditures. And the final chapter of your book probably would be ironically written by Sir Edwin Gibbons about the time of the American Revolution, when he dealt with the subject of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
Well, the final chapter of his book does deal exactly with our becoming accustomed to becoming a global power. Elliot.
Well, you know, I take the point, but the truth is it was the founding fathers who decided to begin the War of Independence even before we had declared independence with the invasion of Canada. And in the book, I talk about it's really Washington who masterminds this, although it's with very much with the hearty support of the Continental Congress, which is pushing him to do it. And their vision of the United States is a very expansive vision, and it includes pushing the British completely out of North America. So, for better or for worse, this is actually goes quite deeply into our DNA, and in fact, it's not until after the War of 1812 that we give up on the idea of conquering Canada. You know, Thomas Jefferson, who you would think would not be inclined this way, at the beginning of the War of 1812 says, well, taking Canada will be merely a matter of marching.
Huh.
And he was all in favor of it. So, you know, this is you had asked me earlier why I'm doing this. I think it's very important to realize that our history is a lot more complicated than we think. That doesn't necessarily mean we're going to like all of it, but it's what we are.
Yeah. To his point about our having bases all over the world, is that necessary now?
Well, that's a very different kind of question.
Right, it is.
You know, I think I'm on the whole somebody who believes that the role the United States has played in the world since World War II has on the whole been very beneficial. That doesn't mean that we haven't made some terrible mistakes. For sure we have. But I think to the extent that the period since 1945 has been one where there's been an absence of really major interstate wars, where there's been a tremendous growth in trade and human prosperity, which is really what's happened since 1945, it's very much because we've been a global presence. And I would add one other point, which is more directly connected with the book. Early on, I say it's very important to realize that what we call World War I and World War II were really World War VII and World War VIII. Mm-hmm. That starting at the end of the 17th century, there are a series of global conflicts, basically between Britain and France, and first the colonies, and then the United States of America, one way or another, is involved in all of them. And we have been engaged with the world really from the outset, well into our colonial past. It's not as if there was some sort of golden past where we kept our distance from the world. Very, very far from it.
You frequently make mention of the comments from the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Policy, Javier Solana, who said Europe has been the territory of war. The U.S. has never been the territory of war. It's why September 11 was so important, the first time their territory had been attacked, which you say is a breathtaking piece of ignorance.
It really is. And, of course, you know, I think the folks in Atlanta or Charleston would probably object to the notion that the United States has never been the territory of war. But again, my point is that actually the formative experiences of the United States were very much those of war. Now, what happens is you have a flood of immigrants who didn't live through that. But for 17th and 18th and early 19th century people, war was very much part of their lives. And it shaped a lot of what this country is like. You know, the founders made a big deal about the president being the commander-in-chief. And that wasn't an honorific. That was understood to be something tremendously important.
Jim, thanks for your call. We go to Ann in Pewaukee next. Hi, Ann.
Hi, this is Ann. Thanks for taking my call. I think that's the first thing you always have to say, right?
Well, it's nice. You don't have to, but thanks.
I was going to ask your guest whether in his book he addresses the United Empire Loyalists, who were the American people during the Revolution who ended up losing their land in New York and that area because they supported England and then were deeded land in Canada and then came back and fought to set the boundaries between Canada and the United States.
Great question, and the answer is absolutely yes. In fact, one of my men in the middle, as I call them, is a fascinating character named Justus Sherwood. That's J-U-S-T-U-S Sherwood. He was one of the Green Mountain Boys, who was one of the founders of Vermont, a friend of Ethan Allen and Seth Warner, but who could not break with the king. He has a variety of hair-raising adventures and ends up running British covert action into Vermont and New York in 1780 and 1781. And he's a very interesting figure. I say at one point he's a decent man in an indecent business because he was engaged in, you know, espionage and covert action and so on. But your listener's making a great point. You know, the American story is a fantastic story, but still there are parts of it that we don't talk that much about, including the Loyalists. Who were a very interesting group of people, and we very much encountered them again in the War of 1812. And it's one of the reasons why I think the United States government was surprised by the amount of resistance that we encountered when we invade Canada, as we do repeatedly during the War of 1812, that the United Empire Loyalists and their descendants really did not want to be part of the United States, and they made that clear on the battlefield.
Well, we do now. My husband is one.
Ah, I see.
And we like Pewaukee, so we're Americans. But he did his history, his genealogy, and he documented his. He's able to have UEL after his name when he writes to Canada.
Oh,
oh, that's interesting. Thanks, Anne,
Thank you so much
for your call. Yeah, bye. John is on the road. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, and I appreciate. I'm not sure if I missed part of the dialogue here, but does your guest recommend anything about the Plains Indians?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I really focus very much on the Northern Indians, so it's the or Northeastern Indians rather. So mainly the Iroquois, the Abnakis, the Mohicans, and some of the others. I don't really get at all into the Plains Indians, unfortunately. One of the larger points, though, that I think we have to be aware of is the tremendous diversity in the Indian world. By the way, one of the reasons why the French were able to hang on in Canada as long as they did was they were much better at managing the diverse Indian groups than the English ever were.
Thanks, John, for your call. Joshua in Milwaukee. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller, a long-time listener.
Thanks.
I just have one question for your guest speaker. We've been talking about the American liberation from the British, and I just was wondering if you know anything about the whole Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, and how we're supposedly liberated from the British, but that is a British-owned company, and all funds and taxes that go towards the IRS go back to the British. I was just wondering your thoughts on that.
I guess my impression is all those checks that I write to the Internal
right.
Revenue Service go to Uncle Sam. So I think we may have a different view of that one.
Yeah. Thanks, Joshua. Robert in Stevens Point. Hi.
Yes. I've heard conflicting stories about whether it was the British who burned the White House in the War of 1812 or the Canadians. Could you clear that one up for me?
I'm pretty sure this was the British. I don't think it was the Canadians. It was part of a very deliberate campaign. Terror is a somewhat strong word, but what happens is the British did not want the War of 1812. When it breaks out, it begins with our invasion of Canada. The Royal Navy is not ready for it. They are, you know, they're finishing off the war with Napoleon, and it's one of the reasons why they were furious with the United States. They thought that we had actually stabbed them in the back, and they felt they were fighting for freedom and not implausibly against Napoleon. Once Napoleon has been put down in 1814, they come across the Atlantic with a vengeance, and the idea is that they're really going to really punish us by burning some coastal towns, conducting these raids, and then imposing a peace which would have left the United States pretty seriously disadvantaged. And that was part of what the operation was about. The burning of the White House and some of the other public buildings in Washington, moreover, was portrayed as a kind of measure-for-measure revenge for the burning of government buildings in York, which is now Toronto, Canada. And so that was the Canadian angle on it, that the British were saying this is retaliation for that. But I'm pretty sure the troops that actually did it were Brits.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. It's another part of American history we just don't know very much about. You walked this whole area too, didn't you?
Absolutely. That was part of the fun of doing the book. Everything I write about, I've walked. Including one of the battles I write about is a smaller fight known as the Battle on Snowshoes,
right.
Which occurred in March. 1758 outside Fort Ticonderoga. So I went up in March with my older daughter and put on snowshoes and snowshoed it. And as I've written the book, I've really tried to give people a sense of place. I think that's that's something an historian ought to do.
Right. It must have been so hard. I often think about people in the Revolutionary War and prior that, and this part of the country, too. Darn it, it was cold. There were the water would freeze over. There was snow. Really uncomfortable.
These were very hard people, and of course they died young. But you come away, I think, or I came away, awed by what these people had to endure, including people who weren't soldiers. One of the chapters begins with a trip that Benjamin Franklin takes north in March. It goes through New York all the way to Montreal. This is a 70-year-old man, and in fact, he's convinced this is going to kill him.
Hmm.
So he's writing these farewell letters to all his friends because he was just so acutely miserable. Fortunately, he survived. But yeah, these are very, very tough conditions.
Mm-hmm. Elliot, thank you so much. Thanks for being with us. Elliot Cullen, our guest, his book is Conquered into Liberty, Two Centuries of Battles Along the Great War Path That Made the American Way of War. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead, so stay with us. I'll be with you again on Monday. We'll have our regular All Things Political at 9 o'clock on Monday, and an interesting 10 o'clock. I know not what it is, but we'll have something interesting, I promise you. Have a wonderful weekend, and thank you for listening.